I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to have a special recorded conversation with former Indianapolis Mayor Bill Hudnut. Hudnut served as mayor of Indianapolis for 16 years. From 1976 to 1992, he dominated the city like few mayors ever have. On his watch, the Colts came to town and Indianapolis stopped being the city that sleeps. The man who made many of those moments possible will give you a rare view from the inside of an important period in Indiana history. Because this is a recorded show, we won't be taking questions via phone call, email, Facebook, or Twitter. But we hope you enjoy this special conversation with a man who helped build the state's largest city, former Indianapolis Mayor Bill Hudnut. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. This is a special recorded version of No Limits, in part because we are having a wonderful opportunity to sit down with former mayor of Indianapolis, Bill Hudnut, in an intimate conversation about his relationship with this city. We won't be taking calls, we won't be getting emails or taking questions via social media, but we do hope you'll enjoy this conversation. Well, Mayor Hudnut, Mayor Bill, as everybody called you, welcome back to Indy.
Well, thank you, John. It's great to be back. It always makes me somewhat homesick to come back. And this morning we checked in at the airport and saw sort of a picturama of a lot of great scenes from Indianapolis neighborhoods. And it just, they were beautiful pictures. And it just made me realize what a great city this is and how privileged I was to be able to serve.
Now, you're back, obviously, because the city is honoring your contributions to its development with the dedication of Hudnut Commons. Can you talk a little bit about what that means to you?
Well, it means a great deal to me. First of all, it means a great deal to me that Mayor Ballard conceived the idea and brought it to the table for discussion, and now it's being implemented. It's a little embarrassing in a way, John, because I don't think you could say that I accomplished anything by myself except to provide some leadership. I always likened the job of the mayor to an orchestra leader who gets a lot of different people playing in harmony with each other with their different parts. But everything we did here was a team effort, whether you're talking about building the original Dome Stadium or the renovation of the canal or some of the downtown revitalization that occurred, Lockfield Gardens and so forth. I didn't do anything alone. Nobody does anything alone. There's no such thing in life as a self-made man or woman. We all stand on the shoulders of others. I stood on the shoulders of Dick Lugar for a long time. And when I became mayor and he went on to become senator, I took over, but the groundwork had already been laid through Dick's work with the Greater Indianapolis Progress Committee, which was a nonpartisan affair that cut across a lot of different lines in the city. We broadened that out, made it more democratic, small d. And the second foundation, of course, that he laid was Unigov. And it was on the basis of those two initiatives that had been taken before I became mayor that I think enabled me and our team to rally around, and everything seemed to be lined up just right in the constellations to do some of the things we did.
Well, you are the only mayor in the city's history to serve four terms. I'd like to, you know, since we've got a chance to talk and we've got a little bit of time, 4 years probably, it's easier to think of in retrospect than it might have been to work through it.
I enjoyed practically all of it.
Okay, well, you're setting me up here. What parts did you not enjoy?
You guys.
The media?
Yeah. In the press, the printed press. I didn't always enjoy them, but you were doing your job. I was trying to do mine. And the other thing that, you know, it gets under your skin a little bit is the critics who are out there and write nasty letters to the editor and this and that and the other thing. But overall, that's about 2% of the 100%. And I just enjoyed the chance to come downtown every day. You never knew it was going to break open like a blizzard in the middle of January in 1978, or a police action shooting that would cause you a lot of difficulty. And those were tense times, and the times are still tense all around in the underbelly of America, in urban America, where police action shootings, particularly when it's a white police officer and a minority victim, and then the exoneration from the grand jury, it's just really set people aflame. And so these problems linger. They're almost insoluble. And that breaks my heart in a way. But we did what we could. We tried. And we didn't always succeed. But the fact of the matter is that in it all and through it all, as my father used to say, we did our best and left the rest.
And
made some mistakes.
You bring up something that I actually plan to talk about a little bit later.
But okay, well, I can wait.
No, since you've...
We're here for a long time.
I do want to talk about the process of running for mayor the first time, why you decided you want to do that. But I think it also, because you're talking about these problems, would it be possible today for a Bill Hudnut, who is, you know, probably the most popular mayor in the city's history, to be elected mayor today? I mean, and I'm putting that in the context of you are a pro-choice Republican. Disagreed with your party on affirmative action in these increasingly partisan times. Would it be possible for someone to have
that kind of career? It might not be. When I came back to run for the empty seat was being vacated by Andy Jacobs, which was my old seat in Congress, but his for a much longer time, and I think it was 1996, he was stepping down. And I came back, and the rap on me at the Republican caucus was that I was too moderate. And this had all changed since the earlier days. And having not been privy to a lot of the political considerations here, I didn't pick up on that as quickly as I should have, to realize that the whole apparatus had moved to the right. And so they nailed me. They said he's pro-choice, he's pro-gun control, which was not exactly true, but that's what one of the labels was, that he's pro-big government, that he's pro-high taxes. I got nailed in 1990 when I ran statewide with having raised taxes 27 times while I was mayor, which stretched a little bit. I mean, every time we installed a fee or the income tax went up 0.1% or something, it was counted by one of the newspapers, and then it got into the public domain, and my opponent in 1990 used that effectively against me. I knew I was going to lose that statewide election in October of 1990. I was still mayor, but I was running for Secretary of State, and lo and behold, a little third grader was tugging at his mom's sleeve as Beverly and I were walking down the parade route at homecoming day in Terre Haute. And she heard him. I didn't hear him say this, but he grabbed his mother's arm and he pointed at me and he says, "Hey, look, Mom, there goes the guy that raised taxes 27 times while he was mayor of Indianapolis." You know, and I figured right then my goose was probably cooked. Because it's hard to defend. I tried to talk about the difference between wild spending and wise spending, about funding services. I would quote one of the chief justices, Justice Brandeis, I think it was, who said taxes, maybe it was Oliver Wendell Holmes, who said taxes are the price we pay for civilization. And I had to give raises to the police department. I had to plow the snow. I had to put asphalt down in the chuck holes. I had to pick up the trash, and as costs escalated, taxes did go up, you know. But what's your choice? Your choice is to reduce services, and I did not want to do that. And in a sense, I paid a price, but I'm proud of the price I paid because I think I was on the right track in what I was trying to do.
There is a school of thought, and I should remind our listeners that we're not taking calls, email messages, or questions via Facebook or Twitter today because we're having this special, intimate, recorded conversation with former Indianapolis Mayor Bill Hudnut. There is a school of thought out there that of the most difficult jobs in American politics, president's number one, but mayor of a major city is number two.
Well,
it skips over governor and senator and all of those others.
I'm disinclined to agree with that. I put mayor number one.
Number one.
I mean, there's a famous saying by Lyndon Johnson to his people. They were all hanging around the Oval Office with a dour face at the end of a bad day. And Lyndon Johnson supposedly said to them, "Cheer up, people. Things could be worse. I could be the mayor of a large city." You're where the rubber hits the ground, you know. The protests are here much more so now maybe than they were 30, 40 years ago. But you're also in this Internet age where people have instant access to you and your people, and the social media can send out all kinds of stuff about you, whether it's true or not. And it's very, very difficult. And I'm not sure, given the culture today, and if you want to say it this way, the Tea Party ideology, that I could be elected in this state anymore. I'm not sure I could be.
What accounts for that? I mean, we've had similar.
Well, my old age, for one thing.
Well, there's that, but we've had conversations similar to this one with former U.S. Senators Richard Lugar and Evan Bayh, both of whom, like you, you know, were famous for trying to find common ground. And they've both sort of said their style of leadership just is not in vogue anymore.
Right.
How did we get to this point?
Well, you know, I hate to point any fingers, and I'm not sure I'm right, but I think it started when Newt Gingrich was elected Speaker of the House, and he had a much more vindictive approach. For example, just to give you one example, which I think is absolutely true, John Myers from Indiana, he was representing Bloomington and Terre Haute and over that way. John Myers had been a longtime member of the Appropriations Committee, and he was the ranking Republican on it. When the Republicans got control, John was, by seniority rights, headed to be the chairman of the committee. And Newt Gingrich wouldn't make him chairman of the committee because Newt was mad at him about something he'd said. And he passed him over, punished him, if you will. And it was that idea of getting punished. You know, let me go back to Gerry Ford. When he was the minority leader and I was in the Congress, I'd go up to him and say, "How does the White House want us to vote on this?" Because you can't know the answer to everything. Every bill that comes along, he'd say, "Well, vote pro or con." But he always would add the caveat, "Vote your conscience and vote your constituents, and we'll understand if you don't go with us." Now it's not that way. Now it's, you know, it's not "I'm okay, you're okay." It's not "I'm okay, you're a scumbag." And it's a much different approach to politics, very unhealthy, I think, for the public democracy, very distasteful to people that have to indulge in it, whether they want to or not. And then, of course, the negative advertising, the humongous amount of monies that's spent on negative advertising, tearing the other fella down, you know, chopping off his head to make you look tall. It's just an entirely different approach. Andy Jacobs and I would never have done this when we were running against each other. He was a perfect gentleman. I tried to be a gentleman. We were great friends. We had opposing candidacies. I beat him once. He beat me once. But to the end of his day, we were good friends because we had that sort of collaborative attitude, that conciliatory attitude, the belief that we had to have civic language being spoken, that we had to be civil and not rancorous. And I'm not trying to brag on myself. I'm just saying that's the way it was, and that's the way it is.
Well, and the fact that two of you, I've always heard the story that when you were running against each other, you often would arrive at the debates or campaign events in the same car that you would drive together because you enjoyed each other's company, even though
we were running against each other. We did, yeah.
And continued to be friends long after running against each other.
And he was such a decent fellow and never said a bad word, just like Dick Lugar. Dick Lugar is one of the most decent gentlemen I've ever known in politics or in life. He is just absolutely true blue 100%. And I've never heard him, and I never really heard Andy say a bad word about anybody.
If you are just joining us, we are in the middle of what is a special, in-depth, and intimate conversation with former Indianapolis Mayor Bill Hudnut, the only four-term mayor in the city's history who's back in town to celebrate the dedication of Hudnut Commons. We aren't taking calls, emails, or taking questions via social media, but we do hope you're enjoying this conversation. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We are having a special, intimate conversation with former Indianapolis Mayor Bill Hudnut. Because this is a recorded conversation, we're not taking calls, taking questions via email, Facebook, or Twitter, but we do hope you will enjoy the conversation. Just before we went to the break, we were talking about the decline of civility and how we got there, and you talked about Andy Jacobs. I'd like to talk a little bit about the run-up, because your period of leadership here in the city was so significant to the city's growth. How you arrived at the decision to run for mayor in the first place?
Well, I lost an election to Andy for Congress, so I, in a sense, was without work. And I had three decisions. I could go back into the church where I'd come from, not Second Presbyterian, but, you know, in church service. Secondly, I could wait and run for Congress again in 1976, it would have been. Or third, I could run for mayor in 1975. I talked it over with some of my, as it were, inside advisors, people like Bruce Melchert, Dave Frick, Lisa Dietrich. And to make a long story short, I went up to see Dick Lugar. And I said, Dick, you and I both lost in 74. I lost to Andy. He lost to Evan's father. And I said, are you going to run for mayor again in 75 next year? He said, no. He said, I'm not going to. And he didn't commit to running for senator, but we knew that was what he was going to do. And so that, in a sense, gave me a free hand. I then made myself, as it were, available to the party. And the party structure in those days was much better organized and much more efficient than it is now. And in those days, a lot of it went right through Keith Bulin, who was the old, quotes, party boss, and was a masterful technician and everything. And to make a long story again short, some other people wanted the job. Tom Hasbrook, who was the blind deputy mayor and a very heroic figure, and I think he'd been president of the city council for quite a while, he wanted it. John Mutz wanted it. He was a very astute businessman, state senator, and so forth. Maybe were there a couple of others. But anyway, in the last analysis, if you can put it this way, the powers that be in the Republican Party gave me the nod. I didn't have the leverage myself. I had a TV show called, no, not the Three Stooges. It was Focus on Faith with a rabbi and myself as a Protestant minister and a Catholic priest. That gave me a little exposure, but I didn't have much exposure. But I came from a church that had great exposure, or the people in it. So I said, well, I'm going to put my hat in the ring. And I was elected in the primary. And then I ran against Bobby Welch in the fall. Welch was not tutored in politics at all. He was a fine gentleman, a good businessman, very, very adamant Notre Dame fan. And he enjoyed, as he said, in every parish he had a committee, a political committee in the Catholic Church. But we debated and debated and debated and stuff and went on. And I was telling the president of UIndy this morning, my friend Rob Manuel, about a time when on a Saturday I used to go around to local events, shake hands during the campaign. And Welch always went up to Notre Dame to see the football games because he was close to Ara Parseghian. Mm-hmm. I can understand that. Well, lo and behold, one day I'm shaking hands down at UIndy, which at that time was called Indiana Central. And I come across a fellow, I can't remember his name, but he was a high-level Democrat and high-level in Welch's campaign. And he just went nuts when he saw me shaking hands around there and knew that his candidate was up in Notre Dame where there were no votes for him. And this guy got, he enjoyed kidding me about it, but he was also very serious. And we just worked our tails off in that campaign. I went door to door, the bicycle and so forth. It was retail politics at the time, much more than it is now. Now it's wholesale politics, even I think at the mayor's level. And so I won. I can't remember by how much. It was not a great deal, maybe 225,000 to 220,000 votes, something like that, over Welch. And then the next three times I ran, I was much better off, and I got somewhere between 66 and 75% of the vote each time and had good majorities, which Mayor Ballard does not have now, on mm-hmm. the city council. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, I was able to work with the majority on the city council and with my team and with the state legislature, which at that time was dominated by what you might call relatively moderate Republicans like Larry Borst, Ned Lampkin, some of those people, to get things done in a cooperative way. And it all just seemed to work out, and we were able to get these projects done, like building the Dome Stadium and renovating the canal, as I mentioned, and some others, because, as it were, the stars were lined up, right? Mm-hmm. For example, we go to build the Dome Stadium. I'm elected to the second term in 1979. Right after that election, I convened a small group of people, movers and shaker types from the Chamber of Commerce, basically, and said, we're on a trail for a football team. And in order to do that, we've got to get a stadium. And in order to get a stadium, we've got to get the money. In order to get the money, you've got to tell us how to fund it. So they worked on it for a while. I had a private conversation with the publisher of your newspaper, John, Gene Pulliam, who said he thought that he could be supportive of the idea if it wasn't on the property tax. And I listened carefully to that. And then we were able to put together various different kinds of monies, and we got the legislation passed at the state legislature, signed by the governor, passed by the city council, then signed by the mayor, myself, to inaugurate a 1% tax on food and beverage served in Marion County, which we did not think was going to be very onerous at all. And together with that and some eleemosynary gifts, because we were not building a football stadium for a major league team, we were building an expansion of the convention center. Mm-hmm. We tried to make that very clear to the IRS and everybody else. We were able to garner $30 million from two charitable trusts here in town, Lilly Endowment and the Kranich Charitable Trust. And then we raised some more money by selling seat rights, suite rights, not mm-hmm. seat rights, suite rights. And at the end of the day, we'd raised $80 million. So we embarked on an $80 million project, not as a freestanding facility out in the cornfields, but as an expansion of the convention center. And we were able to book a lot of new convention business in and enhance our competitive position there, regardless of whether or not we'd gotten a team. Of course, if we hadn't gotten a team, this was the big risk for me politically. It would have been Hudnuts, White Elephant, and What an idiot, spending $80 million of taxpayer money, which was not true, in order to build a giant Taj Mahal where nobody was doing anything. But fortunately, this is another story, the coming of the Colts to Indianapolis. But it came after we had committed and were very pregnant with the stadium.
Yeah.
And as we used to say at the time, I didn't think about the political risk too much then because I thought it was just a great idea and no guts, no glory.
Well, how much of that, I mean, at that time in the city's history, you know, I mean, we were routinely referred to as Naptown. And, you know,
right.
Those were the days when flight attendants, when your plane was landing, would say, set your watch back an hour or 25 years, whichever you prefer.
That rubbed me raw.
Those kinds of jokes. And I remember, you know, when the resurgence took place, there was, I think, a story in the National Geographic that referred to your leadership in that area and said, you know, that part of it was we had a mayor, meaning you, who could sell snow cones to Eskimos. So, you know, how much of that in terms of the challenge that you saw coming in was literally just trying to knock down that perception?
Well, I think it had a lot to do with it. And I was very concerned about that perception. Kurt Vonnegut came from here, and he is reported to have said that Indianapolis is a place where they watch the race one day a year and sleep the other 364. You know, once I was out with Ray Bennison, who was at that time was the head of the Convention and Visitors Bureau. I'm sorry I'm rambling on with stories, but we were going to try to hustle a little convention business. Okay, that's fine. So we're out in San Francisco meeting with a big group of convention planners. They all know each other. Ray and I are on the elevator going down to the meeting, and a nice lady walks on, and she recognizes Ray, of course, and says, "Ray, how you doing? Haven't seen you since you left Kansas City. Where are you now?" He said, "Well, now I'm in Indianapolis. I'm the president of Indianapolis Convention Visitors Bureau." She said, "Oh, my God, Indianapolis." She said, "Well, that place is nothing but a cemetery with lights." And Ray turned to me and said, "I'd like you to meet the mayor of Indianapolis." So we had that image to overcome, and we actually had an image committee early on in 76 and 77. And we hired Jack Raymond out of New York, and we tried to change our image. And that's where Apple is our middle name came from and this and that and the other thing. And gradually, as we moved into the sports arena and hosted certain festivals and built certain venues and got the National Olympic Sports Festival in the early 1980s and started building these facilities, all of a sudden we emerged on the map. And we were no longer regarded as a city in the Rust Belt. We were called the Star of the Snow Belt. And, you know, then the Mayflower trucks came, and that enhanced our reputation more. And what I wanted was that we be known for something beside the race. And I think that, to a certain extent, is true now, that we're known for a lot besides the race. Oh, my goodness, when we came out here for the Super Bowl, it just knocked my socks off. It's just like Times Square on New Year's Eve. And this is Indianapolis?
Yeah.
This is no place? No, no. This is someplace. India's someplace. You know? And all the press talked to me about how wonderful it was to be here because regardless of the weather, they could go from their hotels to the venue for the stadium without going outdoors with the second-level walkways and everything. And it was ideal for them. And one of them said to me, "You know, I didn't have to ride a bus for 45 minutes to get here." And it's that kind of compact downtown that we were aiming at building in order to attract all this economic development potential.
If you are just joining the program, this is a special recorded conversation with former Indianapolis Mayor Bill Hudnut, who's back in the city to celebrate the dedication of Hudnut Commons. We aren't taking email or questions via phone or social media, but we do hope you enjoy the conversation. So was bringing the Colts here, was that the best moment of being mayor, the moment when things turn? Because obviously,
well, it's curious you ask that, because on the one hand, of course, that's what people probably remember more than anything else. They've forgotten about the United Airlines deal, which we cut, which imploded a few years after I left office for various different reasons. And that is remembered, the bringing of the Colts, the building of the stadium, the risk that was taken. And now, of course, they have Lucas Oil Stadium, and the old stadium that I had a hand in was torn down to expand the convention center, to keep our convention business going, which is very important in Indianapolis because we're, you know, the crossroads of America, and we're in the center of the state, and we just can, I think, do very well with convention business of all kinds, particularly maybe religious conventions and medical conventions and so forth. But anyway, I think the convention center is going like gangbusters, and that was part of our plan. And I don't know all the ins and outs about the financing of everything. I've lost track of all that. But certainly the Colts coming enhanced our reputation and is probably something that you want to be remembered by. But by the same token, John, just to give you a really offbeat example, I want to be remembered as the person who danced the jig with a woman downtown in the city county building when she was awarded one of our housing project. What was that called? It was a federal housing program. And we would give dollar houses, and they would promise to put their sweat equity in it for 3 years. And there were so many people that wanted those houses that we had to have raffles. And this lady won a raffle, and she came running down the aisle and threw her arms around me. Oh, thank you, Mayor. Thank you, Mayor. You know, those little things make a difference. Or going out to a neighborhood corner and putting in a stop sign to help children on bicycles and so forth. And all those little things were important to me, too. Or going to a senior citizens center and visiting once a month with a senior citizen. And we went to the high schools and talked with a lot of the high school people around the county and the city, you know, the seniors and so forth, and the government people. And it was a question of big projects plus little people that all added up to changing, I think, the tenor of the city. And the result, I think, has been a much more lively, vibrant city than it was. And I'm not trying to brag on myself. As I said, it was a team effort, and it's carried on under my successors. And now it's been almost 30 years since I was mayor. I left mayor in 91, so my arithmetic's not very good. It's been 23. But, you know, those were great times. And at that time, there was a different atmosphere and environment about politics, and you tried to get things done, and you worked together, and you were willing to compromise and figure out how we can get this done. I used to say to the bureaucrats in City Hall, don't tell me, as they often did, why this can't be done. Tell me why it can be done or how it's going to be done. And it's that kind of entrepreneurial approach to leadership that I think is important, of having a vision, communicating the vision, and implementing the vision.
You talk about dancing the jig with it.
Yeah.
That woman. I mean, I've covered mayors in this city now for 35 years or so. And I can say, I'm probably breaking format here, one of the things I think that made your tenure so distinctive is that was a part of the job that you really enjoyed.
I really did.
Human contact.
Do you remember that picture on the front page of the Indianapolis News of me in the leprechaun suit?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah. For the St. Paddy's Day parade.
Yeah, right. And my wife Beverly conceived that idea. Put me in a leprechaun suit, a big, tall guy like me in a leprechaun suit.
6'4", 6'5",
yeah.
Somewhere around
yeah.
there.
Yeah, but, you know, people remember an image like that. And I remember one of your reporters called me up like at 1 o'clock in the morning. And I'll tell you after
the
show
who it
was. I
bet that part of the job you don't miss. Yeah.
that wasn't great. But he said, Bill, you're not going to believe the picture that's going to be in the paper tomorrow. And people remember that.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with former Indianapolis Mayor Bill Hudnut, who's back in town to mark the dedication of Hudnut Commons. This is a recorded show, so we're not taking questions. Hope you enjoy the conversation. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. If you are just joining us, we're having a special conversation with former Indianapolis Mayor Bill Hudnut, who's back in the city, to mark the dedication of Hudnut Commons. We aren't taking calls or emails or Facebook messages or questions via Twitter today because this is a recorded conversation, but we do hope you enjoy it. Well, we were talking about some of the best moments, the things you enjoyed. What were some of the worst moments as mayor, the hardest moments?
Well, there were two that come to mind. One was when we were challenged with the problem of what do we do with our trash? Do you put it in a landfill? If so, where's the landfill going to be? And frankly, all heck broke loose. And people protesting the decision to put a landfill in Marion County came out in droves. Some of them had rats in a cage. Some of them had ashes that they spread around saying, this is going to be in our backyard. At one city county meeting, or meeting in the city county building, which ultimately reduced my public works director to tears, Barbara Gold, everybody in the house had on a, and there were hundreds of people there, Hudnut cash burner, because this was I'd come up with this $120 million idea to incinerate the trash. And $120 million sounds like a heck of a lot. And there again, where are we going to put the incinerator? Well, we put it down at the sewage treatment plant, and that's why the street into the sewage plant is named Hudnut Boulevard, which I didn't catch on to at first, but the Public Works Department did that. And so there we are with the Public Works challenge of disposing of, I can't remember the figure, how much trash each day, but it was a lot. But the idea was resource recovery. The idea was to take the trash, to burn it up, turn it into steam, and sell it back into the steam loop to heat and cool downtown. And I think that's a good idea, and that's what we eventually did. But then what do you do with the toxic stuff that's left over? Well, I don't know if it still is, hauled to a landfill way out in rural Indiana somewhere. I don't know where. And we had that problem. But the grief you took from people, I mean, having 150 people ganging up on you, booing you every time you'd open your mouth, you know, was tough. And then, of course, the second thing was, well, let's be honest about it, race relations, trying to keep the peace, trying to give the minorities more opportunity in the sunshine of civic life here. For example, I came on the board, and I remember Sam Jones from the Urban League sort of scolding me and half kidding me that there were no African Americans on the Airport Authority board. I said, you're right, Sam. So I got one on there. Pointed a number of other minorities, including Joe Slash as deputy mayor, and then Paula Parker Sawyers, both African Americans. And then the first week I was in office, I said, I issued an executive order, I guess you'd call it, and I said, no recruit class for the fire or the police department is going to be constituted unless 20% of them I think it was 20. I don't think it was 25. I think it was 20. 20% of them are minorities or women. Because I was concerned that in a city where at that time the minority population was like 20%, 12% of the police department and less percent of the fire department were minorities. And I wanted to increase that proportion because in my gut, I felt that it was perfectly appropriate and proper and wise for African-Americans to police African-Americans, not whites. But I never got to the 20%. I tried. The Reagan Justice Department sued me to dismantle this program. I went to the Justice Department and talked with William Bradford Reynolds, who at that time was the head of their Civil Rights Division, and they were suing Indianapolis. And I said, I'm going to stick to my guns, and as long as I'm the mayor, even if it's not possible to do this with the kind of orders that I've gotten out of Washington, I'm going to do it voluntarily because I think it's the right thing to do. And I was very concerned about that to the point where we appealed decisions, and it went ultimately sort of up to the Supreme Court, which upheld our point of view at that time with regard to this kind of affirmative action policy in the police department. I'm talking about the 1970s, when you had a lot of good old boy syndrome at work, you know, and cousins were being hired and grandchildren and so forth, and it was kind of a closed network, and I thought it had to be opened up. And it was very difficult. I mean, we just to show you how difficult it is, we got a picture of one of our police officers at a Norman Rockwell rally with a swastika armband.
What do you mean, John Rockwell? The
not Norman Rockwell.
John Rockwell.
Thank you. Yes. The radical right.
Yeah.
Fascist type.
Yeah.
He's at one of his rallies.
Yeah.
Well, I was told by the lawyers and by the merit board, you can't get rid of him just because he's wearing that. It's free speech. And the only way you can get rid of him is if you can demonstrate that it shows up in his conduct toward African-Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And so I couldn't get rid of him, but it was very painful to me to have a guy like that on the police department. Another example was when there was a police action shooting. Very often, if the victim was minority and the police officer was white, there would be an eruption.
Mm-hmm.
Not like Ferguson, thank God. Not like Louisville, not like Boston. But there would be an eruption.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Jesse Jackson came down once to hold a prayer vigil on a corner where a policeman had shot a black kid. Theoretically, the boy was unarmed.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the Michael Taylor incident, which triggered a great protest to the point where I'm out of town and I get a call from people saying, you better get back here because the preachers are on the steps demanding your resignation and that of the police chief.
We probably ought to explain, too, that the Michael Taylor incident, because it was quite a few years ago, was African-American young man who was killed by a gunshot wound in the, if I remember right, in the backseat of a police cruiser. And, you know, the debate was about where he got the gun. He was, I think, handcuffed at the time.
Well,
I remember if he managed to get it out, if he had it on him or whatever, and there was a lot of debate.
Well, the theory that I had was that, and I think it's pretty well corroborated, was that he had sequestered it in a high-top sock, and in the pat-down, it was summertime, they missed it.
Mm-hmm.
And they put him in the backseat of the car and handcuffed him with his hands behind his back.
Mm-hmm.
And police officer gets out of the driver's seat, walks around to let him out of the car, and he's dead.
Yeah.
And who knows whether he was trying to shoot himself, whether it was an accident, or whether he was planning to shoot the officer.
Or just try to get rid of the gun.
Or try to get rid of the gun. It was an accident.
Yeah.
It was a sad, sad thing, and sad for the family. And that's the kind of thing that breaks your heart. But then to have these preachers in whose pulpits I had spoken many times standing up, asking me to resign, one of whom I had, when I was in Congress, I'd taken over to the Congress to have the opening prayer. Mm-hmm. This fellow stayed a wonderful guy. He stood up and he said, you know, as a son of a sharecropper, this is a great honor for me to be giving the opening prayer at the Congress. Mm-hmm. There he was on the steps. And it was sort of this knee-jerk emotional reaction that always is triggered by an event like that that really caused a lot of grief.
How much of that also is, I mean, we've talked about the really intense personal connection people felt with you as mayor, which was a good thing when they, you know, wanted to dance jig with you and all of that or celebrate, but also could be that they personally would hold you accountable when something didn't go right.
Well, that's the job of the mayor, the lightning rod. Mm-hmm. And you just had to tough your way through it. And you had, in my opinion, you have public discourse was important and public meetings at which the protesters had a lot to say, and you had to listen. When we were involved in what we called the Pride Movement, peaceful in Indianapolis to desegregated, peaceful response in Indianapolis to desegregated education, and the judge had ordered busing out mm-hmm. into some of the whiter townships from Central Township. Mm-hmm. You know, we worked awfully hard to avoid a combustible situation there. We set up a group that was oriented toward trying to help solve these interracial problems that would occur in a Perry Meridian if some mm-hmm. group from downtown was bussed out there. And on and on. And this affirmative action program, we just kept at it with the police and fire departments. That's why I got the Rosa Parks Award once after I'd left office for affirmative action. And it's always going to be with us. But the chief thing, I think, is love thy neighbor as thyself. The chief thing is to have respect for the other person. And not to let the whole situation devolve into violence and riots and abusive behavior and all that. And we really had very little of that. We were lucky the night that Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. Dick was the
mayor.
Yeah. Was the mayor at the time, and he was up there at 16th and Broadway or wherever it was. And Bobby Kennedy came forth. Yeah. He was in town and gave what, in retrospect, is one of the great speeches in American history.
Yeah,
right there. On the platform of a truck mm-hmm. in the park over there, and it calmed people down.
Is that the thing? Because you're right. We forget that period of history, particularly the battles over busing in Boston and other major cities in America, were violent. I mean, these weren't rhetorical or political fights. In some places, they were almost like combat zones.
Yep.
Indianapolis didn't have any of that during that time, during the period that you were mayor. Is that the thing you take the most satisfaction
out of? Well, I take a lot of satisfaction out of that, and I'm sure Dick does too, because the essence of leadership is basically, come, let us reason together. You know, and as my father used to say to me, avoid the acute angle. I used to say to my labor negotiators when we were negotiating with labor people with new contracts, don't walk away from the table. Stay there, keep the doors open, don't get backed into a corner, and let's get this resolved, and we'll just keep massaging it and working at it. And it's that kind of an attitude rather than my way or the highway that I think is more effective as a leadership style. Now, that's just me. But I think to a very large extent, it was also Dick Lugar's leadership style. And I can't speak for people subsequently because I left town shortly after I ceased being mayor. But the key is to try to make a community. Community means coming into unity. The Commonwealth is for the common good, you know. And keeping your eye on what's good for the most people, not pleasing a certain faction, I think is important. And doing what you think is right. I can remember once an old pundit, you know him very well, worked for your newspaper, the Indianapolis News. He and I used to have lunch together, and he said, Bill, he said, if you put bricks on the circle.
Imitation, too. I got to say that.
Said, well, this was after his third martini. Yeah. I never had one. Bill, he said, if you put bricks on the circle, you'll never be reelected to anything again. And I remember an old state senator in my church telling me the same thing. But we put bricks on the circle, and I was reelected. You got to do what you think is right in life.
Yeah.
And you, without being vainglorious about it, which I'm not trying to be.
Yeah.
You just got to have the courage of your convictions to be humble about it, to say, I'm doing the best I can. I know I'll make mistakes. I made a lot of mistakes.
Which ones do you regret the most?
Well, trying to tear down all of Lockfield Gardens, for one. Okay. And that was a mistake. And I got the wrong advice from some of the key leadership in the African-American community who said, tear it down, because it was blighted. But I was not as sensitive as I should have been, and I surely became sensitized to it. The deep feelings of rootedness that the African-American community had in the Lockfield Gardens area and up along Indian Avenue and Madison C.J. Walker and all the rest of it. And so I had to be sensitive to that, so we backed off. We didn't tear down the whole project. We restored some of it. We built some new. And now instead of, rusty doors swinging to and fro on hinges, it's and weeds growing up and rats and a big barbed wire fence around it, 575 units or whatever it is of good living.
Do you miss the job?
Yeah, I miss a lot of it. But I realize also that it's for people with a lot of energy. It takes an incredible amount of time. It has tremendous rewards. I mean, just the feeling of accomplishment compared to what I felt when I was in Congress. In the executive branch of government, you can do so much. And my mantra was entrepreneurial leadership, being willing to take risks, forming partnerships, you know, and doing the kind, building on your strengths, not trying to be somebody you're not. We could never be a Chicago. People said, are you going to have the Republican convention here? I said, probably not. I'm not sure we're big enough at that time. Maybe they are now. And you have to be what you are in life and bloom where you're planted. And Indianapolis, I think, bloomed a long ways thanks to the efforts of a great many people in the 1970s, 1980s, and starting with Dick Lugar back in 67.
What are you going to be thinking when they dedicate HUDNET Commons? What thoughts? We've got just a few seconds left.
Well, the first thought will be, thank God this is a recognition ceremony and not a memorial service. Secondly, my thought will be that I will achieve immortality with the pigeons. My third thought was that I'm embarrassed to be up here because it was such a team effort all the way along the line. And I did not do anything by myself, and I'm getting a lot of credit for it because I did happen to be in the right position at the right time. But I'm so grateful for the teams that we assembled, which were so good, and everything seemed to be lined up, and the atmosphere was different, as we've discussed, much more conciliatory, much more willingness to work things out. So I hope as we look back, we can think the HUDNET years were good years. He built well, and he cared about people.
Thank you very much. We've enjoyed talking with you. And thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.